the College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Back for another week of the College Football Fix Podcast presented by USA Today Sports. I'm Dan Wolkin. He's Paul Meyerberg. Goodness gracious, we have so much to talk about today. Just nonstop college football news. I guess we got to start with the College Football Playoff Selection Committee finally releasing their first top 25 of the year. Ohio State is the number one team in the CFP poll. Georgia number two, Michigan number three, Florida State number four. If the playoff were picked today, that would be your final four. Of course, it's not picked today. A lot of football left to play. You know, it's one of those things, Paul, where, yeah, like intellectually it makes sense to me that Ohio State is number one because they've got the two big wins at Notre Dame, Penn State at home. Nobody else really has two wins of that quality. But I guess I wasn't really mentally prepared for the Ohio State to be number one because eye test wise, they just don't really seem to measure up. But it's funny because we talk about parity. It's been a topic, parity. And yet it's three teams that were in the playoff last year in Florida State. I don't think this is what parity looks like.
Yeah, it's weird because Ohio State has not looked like the number one team in the country at any point this season. So that's why we're like struggling with the concept of the Buckeyes being number one. But they do this a lot. Like we've been doing this committee nonsense. This is the 10th season that we've been doing these TV shows. And we just know that the first time, like with the initial debut rankings, they always follow the protocol. You know, yeah. They're like always, they're very attuned to the protocol. You know, the protocol tends to be dismissed more and more as you get closer to December. But this is a protocol. We know the rules. We did our jobs ranking. That's why you have Ohio State number one. So I'm fine with it. Who cares? I mean, not just because Ohio State and Michigan are going to play, but I mean, who cares in general? But yeah, that's it. I don't have any qualms, Dan. Like I want to have a hot take about the playoff rankings. I just don't have one.
So Michigan number three, it's interesting because first of all, Michigan hasn't played anybody, but they've been the most dominant team. They're winning games by, you know, an average of basically 34 points a game. Nobody's come close to touching Michigan, but the best team they've played is Rutgers at this point. Meanwhile, they've got this whole sign-stealing thing hanging over their head. More developments on that we'll get into in a second. I found it very interesting, probably the most interesting part of the entire show, was when they have Boo Corrigan, who's the head of the committee, on ESPN after they do the rankings, and he takes some questions. It's usually not very interesting, and I tend to just ignore it. I hardly ever jump on the conference call they do at the meet after that because, like you said, who cares? There's just really nothing they can say that's very illuminating. But I did want to hear what he had to say about Michigan and how they handled the Michigan issue. And on television, he says essentially that this is not a CFP issue. It's an NCAA issue. Okay, that's how they've basically chosen to handle it. Should note, by the way, that Ward Manuel, the athletic director at Michigan, is on the selection committee, which is like a whole other weird twist to this. Although when Michigan comes up, he's supposed to leave the room. All right. But essentially, the CFP committee has made a decision that they're not going to touch this sign-stealing thing. They're just going to put it over in the corner and ignore it. It's not there. There's nothing been proven. It's just allegations. Even though, like, we know they were stealing signs, clearly. Obvious now. Connor Stallions was out there doing stuff to steal signs. We don't necessarily know the exact extent of everything, but come on. We get the picture here. Then they do this conference call with the media, and Corrigan right away goes down through the top four teams, gives like one little comment about each and says, yeah, Michigan number three, they've just been incredibly dominant, and that's why the committee likes them. So I jump on to ask a question to Boo Corrigan, and I say, hey, listen, Boo, so I saw you on television, and you said, this is not a CFP issue, it's an NCAA issue. Then you come on here and you say, the reason you got Michigan number three is how dominant they've been. But, you know, it would seem to me, as somebody who's been following this committee for years and years, I understand exactly the language you guys speak. I understand how granular in the detail, in the data, you guys look at things. How is it possible for you to get on here and say, this is not a CFP issue, while at the same time praising Michigan for how dominant they've been, when there's a very real possibility that one of the reasons they've been so dominant is that they've been cheating? They've been taking information illegally and using it to beat the brains in of all their opponents. So how can you just not even talk about this at all? I don't know. I find that to be unacceptable.
I mean, they punted on that question so fast.
Very fast. In fact,
let me just Big Ten level punting.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. They punted on it so fast that Boo Corrigan never actually answered my question. Bill Hancock jumped in with his talking points that they've written on a piece of paper and essentially just would not let Boo Corrigan answer the question, right. which I personally was annoyed by.
Yeah, and he's the velvet glove, right? He'll come on and answer the questions with his style. So look, I think you're raising a really interesting question. So I'm going to try to look at it from both sides of the argument. The question you asked yesterday about how you can divorce the dominance you see on the field from what we're beginning to believe very strongly, though we can only say what we believe to be true at this point, obviously, because we haven't seen the full takeaway from whatever investigation is going to happen into Connor Stallions in Michigan. That's a difficult concept for me to wrap my head around at this point. And I think you asked a good question. You wrote a good column off it. From the college football playoff perspective, I also understand what they're doing here, right? Yeah. Because like you understand they've been given the option of punting on this and punting and punting and punting. So they're going to take it. Like to say that, like as Hancock responded to you and paraphrasing, he said essentially, we're just going off. Like, we don't know any more than you do. Like, we can only go off what we see on the field. And that's just going to be what they say and say and say until there's something of note to take away officially from the Michigan story. Question is, Dan, like, seems to me November 1st right now, this has the potential to be the most disruptive scandal storyline that the college football playoff has ever come into contact with. What do they do if Michigan is 12-0, 13-0 even on Saturday, December 3rd, I believe. But there is a story out there and there's an official report out there detailing how they stole signs. What does the playoff committee do then? That to me is looming and it could be a huge, huge story for the playoff and for college football.
Yeah. And look, I'm not stupid. I understand what's going on here. I understand how all this works. And I understand why the selection committee does not want to put a stamp on this publicly, especially right now. I get all of that. You know, I think sometimes people misunderstand what our jobs are generally, and particularly what mine is. I mean, we dealt with this a lot, like during the COVID thing, when, you know, anytime you question anything, people are up in your social media mentions talking about why you hate the sport you cover, blah, blah, blah. Look, my job, as I see it, is to hold people accountable, okay? And that's all I'm trying to do here is hold the selection committee accountable for the way they approach this, because it is delicate. It is unique. It's not something we've ever seen before, something like this unfolding in real time as the season's going along. It's totally unprecedented, and I'm not saying that there's one right way to do it. But this is a selection committee we have heard in the past, years gone by, go to such a granular level of evaluating teams to the point of absurdity. Do you remember Jeff Long years ago talking about body clocks? Stanford, Stanford lost a season opener at Northwestern in a game that started at, I believe, 11 a.m. Central, which would have been a 9 a.m. kick. Stanford was very highly ranked, you know, in the preseason, and I guess by the time that – I can't remember exactly where they were, but by the time the selection committee released the first ranking, Stanford had, I think, not lost again, so they were up there, right? And they're talking about, yeah, we're making a somewhat of an allowance on Stanford because the body clocks were off in that season opener. Like, that is the level of absurdity you deal with sometimes with this committee. So it just strikes me as odd that a committee that prides itself on being on top of everything, going into the weeds as deep as they can to try to learn about how good these teams really are, that they would just not address what is a huge elephant in the room as far as I'm concerned. And look, I am tired of the Michigan fans or anybody else saying, oh, this is no big deal. Like, they're not really gaining an advantage. Stop. Okay. I will fully allow that no matter what Michigan did, they were going to be 8-0 at this point in the year. Cause they're probably just better than all these teams. They haven't played anybody, but it blows my mind actually that anyone who has watched football or understands football at any level would actually say that what Michigan did doesn't have an impact on the games. If they've obtained information in a way that is against the rules that tells them or gives them a great idea of what play the opponent is running, that's the whole thing. Like, that's everything in football. I shouldn't say it's everything. It's not everything. There's a physical component to the game that you still have to execute, and you still have to block and tackle and do all that stuff. But come on. If you know what play's coming, that's a huge deal. I don't know how anyone could deny that.
Yeah, of course it's a huge deal. I mean, it's like, it's a game changer. But the question, I guess, is like, what do you do with it?
No, that's right.
What do you do with the knowledge that, like, this shared consensus that Michigan has violated the rules? Like, what do you do with it? So the committee better get an answer. Like, they can't be left holding the bag, you know, in 28 days or in a month and not have a backup plan. They need to know what they're doing. So it's good to hammer them. It's good to ask the question. That is, I think the answer is going to suck. That the answer we get is going to suck until there's some credible or official news out of this Michigan story. But I don't know. I don't know if they're 11-1 and they lose to Ohio State by a point and they've beaten everyone else by a million. Like, is this going to be a deciding factor that keeps them out? Maybe. I really don't know. As we know, the committee does use what they can. You know, they always try to find a way to use whatever they can at their disposal. And it's funny, like, we used to treat everything that they said as like just ridiculous. Like, every single word that Jeff Long would say, or who was the first?
No, Jeff was the first. Jeff Long was the first.
That was because he was riding the wave from the Brett Bielema, the letter he wrote to Brett Bielema or something like that. Like, everyone.
Well, I think it was the Petrino. I mean, you have to go all the way
Petrino,
back.
Right.
The Petrino,
right?
Petrino firing.
Right. So we used to like parse through every single thing that they said. This is like, this Michigan thing has the potential to be just like that because they can't continue to punt on it, but they probably will.
Yeah, I would also recommend to everybody to go read. Bruce Feldman and Max Olson did a piece in The Athletic. They talked to like 50 coaches and did sort of a survey on just how serious the Michigan allegations are. And I thought there was a lot of good stuff. I mean, it's all sort of anonymous quotes, which that sort of gets into a bit of a weird territory, and every news outlet's different. I mean, we're not really, you know, at our place, like, we don't really do stories where people sort of give an opinion anonymously. That's just kind of one of those lines. But, you know, when you can do a story like that, it's interesting. And I thought there was a lot of good stuff in there. And, you know, I think the vast majority of coaches, it mirrors sort of what I hear when I've talked to people over the last couple of weeks, that this is a big breach. It's a big breach. Now, the good news is presumably they will have to play Ohio State and Penn State without Connor Stallions' help. So we'll have a pretty good idea, right? And if they lose one of those games, I don't think they're going to get in because they just don't have the schedule. They don't have the schedule strength, yeah. I don't think. Well, I guess theoretically they could lose to Penn State, beat Ohio State, still make the Big Ten championship game,
exactly.
Whatever. I heard some disappointment that Florida State was number four from their side because they do have that big win over LSU. I get it. I just don't know. You know, you could certainly have flip-flopped them with Michigan because they had that one real win. I think Florida State's on a path that they just have to keep winning. They just have to keep winning, win the ACC, go undefeated. They have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, no concerns for them. I thought Michigan would be four as well because if you're going to put Ohio State number one, it stood to reason that they would use the same logic throughout the top four. Always thought Washington would be five because they're not going to put Washington in the top four above those four teams. But Florida State's good. They got to beat Miami on the 11th. They end at Florida. I believe that's in the Swamp. And then you're going to get Louisville very likely in the ACC championship game. So, yeah, they take care of business. They're in. That's just not even – that's just not something that's realistic of concern. You go 13-0 from the Power 5. We just know this. You're getting it.
Yeah, Washington number five and Oregon number six. There were several of those Pac-12 teams a little further down the rankings. I sent out a tweet on Saturday that got a lot of traction. And basically what I said was, at this point, I only see three teams that can win the national championship. In my opinion.
Okay.
Michigan, Georgia, and Oregon.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, we both are Oregon people. Like we said this last week, Oregon is a team that could absolutely win the national championship. And I think it's like we talk about the playoffs so much that we almost like we talk about who can make the playoff. There are a lot of teams that can make the playoff.
For sure.
There are very few that can win one game, and there are even fewer that can win two. And I think Oregon can win two games. I really do. But certainly Michigan and Georgia, we have no doubt that those two can do it. And I don't know about Ohio State yet. I credit them for finding ways to win, but I really think you're right. Those three teams, I would pick those three teams in a game against everyone else. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Any other opponent you could have match up with any one of those three teams, I'm taking one of those three teams. That's just the truth.
As good as Ohio State's defense is, the way they're playing offense right now, I find it hard to see how they would beat a Georgia on a neutral field and even how they would beat an Oregon. I mean, Oregon's explosive.
Yeah.
And obviously Michigan will find out. They're playing in Ann Arbor. You have to sort of put that in a little different category because, you know, they play each other every year. It's a rivalry game. There's not a lot of secrets there. It's just a different kind of thing. It's interesting because the committee has Washington 5, Oregon 6, and they're doing it out of deference to the result. Those two teams have played. They played in Seattle. Washington won. But I would bet that if you polled that committee one by one, most of the people in that room would say that Oregon's a better team.
No. Every single one of them would, and the evidence is, well, I wouldn't say every single one of them, but obviously more than six of them would, because you've got Texas, which beat Alabama on the road behind
right.
the road. So that's your example. They believe that Oregon is one of the best teams in the country, and seems to me that if Washington loses a game before they potentially meet Oregon, that they would probably fall behind Oregon, if that makes any sense. Like, despite the head-to-head loss, if Washington and Oregon had the same record, seems to me like Washington would be lower. They said something interesting about him, Corrigan did. He actually said, like, Washington number five, they got a good win, but they played terribly the last 2 weeks. So they've got a credibility issue with the committee so far right now, Washington.
Yeah, look, here's the reality for Washington, okay? they beat Oregon 36-33 on October 14th. We talked about that game. We all watched that game. Dan Lanning's fourth down decisions. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff that could have easily flipped that outcome. Like one or two things flip that outcome. But it happened. You have to respect that. You have to respect the score and the outcome of that game. But look at what has sandwiched that performance. Washington goes to Arizona, you know, a good team, but certainly not a playoff contending type of team. And they win by 7. They had to recover an onside kick or that thing would have gotten hairy. They come back the week. Okay, then they beat Oregon. The next week, they beat Arizona State 1-7 Arizona State. Or no, 2-6. 2-6 Arizona State. They beat them 15-7 and needed to come back in the fourth quarter to do it. Not a great look for Washington. All right, you know, okay, it's a hangover game. You can make all the excuses, right? They didn't take it seriously. But you want to see and you expect them maybe to come out the next week and to really stamp their authority against another bad team, a Stanford team. And it's on the road, but still, like if you're a real national title team, like you go take care of business against, you know, 2-6 Stanford. What happens? It's like literally touch and go the entire way. It's 28-26 going into the fourth quarter. It's 35-33 with 6.5 minutes to go. You know, they do win the game, but 3 out of the last 4 Washington games have been hold on for dear life against teams that are nowhere near the playoff race. And in the case of Arizona State and Stanford, 2 teams that are going to finish with losing records. That's just not what a national championship team looks like. You can excuse one bad game like that, or, you know, I mean, maybe 2, but 3 out of the last 4. No, I'm sorry. I think you have to look at it and say the Oregon game is the outlier here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's Washington's on a 15 game winning streak, right? They went 11-2 last season, if I remember correctly. So I don't want to call them a flash in the pan, but I just don't know if at this point they're quite at that stage as a program to really be in this conversation as a legitimate team. And that's not, that is very disrespectful. I'm not going to say it's not. But the truth is, like you said, like Florida State had a Boston College game. It happens. Ohio State has had, take your pick of any one of those games. I mean, you could pick one that qualifies as their close call. But all of those teams successfully bounce back from that, and they don't put back-to-back together. They don't allow for over-scrutiny of flaws because they're consistently strong. I think Washington, for the better part of a month, has not been consistently strong. They won a rivalry game with some quirks to it, and the image they're putting together for the committee is just, it's going to be a problem for them. I mean, if they don't go 13-0, if they continue to stack together unimpressive wins, it's going to be a problem for them. So, Oregon clearly has a credibility boost with the committee, and Washington just does not. I mean, even having beaten Oregon. So, interesting conundrum to think about. I mean, you could have Washington on the inside looking out no matter what, doesn't matter. But if they are 12-1 and Pac-12 champ, you got to wonder what their reputation will be. So, that's one thing to think about. I think that's probably one of the most interesting Power 5 comparisons of last night was the Washington-Oregon conversation.
Yeah. And the other thing that seems clear to me from not just looking at the rankings, but just the way the entire season is playing out, I think the Big 12 is in some trouble. Don't you agree? Because, look, the Oklahoma loss last week to Kansas, honestly, not that surprised. I believe we both actually had that as our bold prediction.
Okay.
That we do going into the weekend that Kansas was going to win that game. Because we had just seen Oklahoma come back to earth a little bit. Water finding its level. Oklahoma had played above its head for several weeks. The Texas game, I think they played better than what they are. You know, Texas now is dealing with this Quinn Ewers thing. How long is that going to go on? Like, there's certainly a path where either Oklahoma or Texas wins the Big 12 championship game and kind of sneaks in somehow. But honestly, like, especially if it's Oklahoma and they're sitting there with one loss, and you compare them to an Ohio State or Michigan with one loss, could get dicey.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Texas at 12-1 is a different animal because they'll have avenged their they'll have avenged probably their loss, and they'll have an Alabama win. But yeah, Oklahoma at 12-1, like, what if Ohio State's 11-1, already obviously number one team, so they've got the committee seal of approval, and they lose to Michigan by a field goal
on the road.
So they're in trouble. Big 12 is in trouble if it's Oklahoma, but I think Texas is probably a good shape to. I think 12-1 Texas is in.
It's been interesting. Everyone's kind of putting out their 12-team bracket, mm-hmm. what it will look like next year when this playoff expands. And that's all fun and interesting to look at. But the problem is, and we talked about this in a meeting, like projecting this out. Yeah, it's easy to do right now looking at this year's data. But it really is apples and oranges because next year the conferences are all going to be totally different. Mm-hmm. In other words, like this year, if you look at the 12 team, right now Oklahoma and Texas would both be in. But next year they're going to be in the SEC.
Right.
Washington and Oregon both in. Next year they're going to be in the Big Ten. So the current 12-team bracket would actually have 5 Big Ten teams and 5 SEC teams if you look at next year's conference configuration. But we know that's not going to happen because the schedules are going to be different. The standings are going to be different. I actually think it's going to be hard. I actually think it's going to be much harder to come up with a coherent 12-team bracket at this point in the year because the conference schedules are going to be so all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be no consistency. Some people are going to play really tough schedules. Some people are going to play really easy schedules. 18-team conferences, 16-team conferences. I actually think it's going to be a bit of a mess. And I actually think we're going to be sitting here 1 year from now looking at the way this committee interprets all this data with these mega conferences. I actually think that's when people are going to be mad about these rankings because I think it's going to be somewhat impossible to do.
No, yeah, somewhat, for sure. I mean, I just hadn't thought about this, but 11 of the top 12 are Big Ten SEC. Next year, yeah. Big Ten SEC. Obviously, the math doesn't work anymore when you start thinking that you can't have all these unbeaten teams at this point of the year from two leagues, but it's going to be a mess. I'm ready for it. I think it's good to have a little bit of controversy back into this deal, but yeah, I don't know how it's going to look. Like, are you going to see the same clumping of one or two leagues dominating the top of the poll when they're playing 16 team conference, tougher games, more games? I really don't know, but you can't, like you said, you can't really like extrapolate, like this is what the playoff would look like in a 12 team field. When you remember that it's not really realistic compared to what 2024 is actually going to look like. So yeah. It'd be interesting to think about what, like, if you just went through and looked at future conference affiliation, what 2024 would look like compared to this year's standings. But yeah, it's an interesting exercise that is ultimately meaningless.
One last little piece of business on the committee rankings. They had a Tulane, one-loss Tulane, one spot ahead of undefeated Air Force for the group of five bid. Do you think it's going to stay that way? I mean, does Air Force have opportunities to, if they remain undefeated? I find it hard to believe that an undefeated Air Force at the end of the day would be below a one-loss Tulane.
But they already are, which is the thing. Like,
I find that curious. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I thought for sure Air Force was going to be higher. The argument that they're not is because Tulane's got three wins against against FBS teams with a non-losing record. Air Force has got one. So that's the argument. Also, I mean, Corrigan even said yesterday, Tulane, when they played Ole Miss, they didn't have Pratt. They lost by 17. So they're laying the groundwork here. I think Tulane is going to stay above Air Force. Air Force plays UNLV, Boise. They'll probably play Fresno. So there's a chance. But if you're already up 7-1 against 8-0, you're already a spot ahead. I just don't know how you seed that ground. So that's unbelievably good news for Tulane.
All right, let's get into some of the news of the week. We do have to talk a little bit about the latest in the Connor Stallions mystery. There were pictures that started popping around the internet on, you know, Sunday, Monday, that seemed to show somebody wearing sunglasses on the Central Michigan sideline in the season opener. They played Michigan State. It looks very much like Connor Stallions. It is not confirmed by anybody yet to be Connor Stallions. Looks like him, except for the fact that the person wearing the hat seemed to have hair, which Connor Stallions in other pictures of him seems to not have hair on his head. I love the sleuthing.
That was his disguise. That's like when Bobby Valentine put a mustache on.
It would be very easy to get a wig, yes. Jim McElwain, so Central Michigan played Tuesday night. Earlier Tuesday, the AD at Central Michigan essentially acknowledged publicly that they're looking into this. Jim McElwain, after the game, I don't know exactly how to sum this up, but I think the big takeaway is if Central Michigan's like, no, that's not Connor Stallions, that's one of our GAs, it's just a case of, you know, lookalikes, mistaken identity. I did love Bill Connolly from ESPN posted a tweet yesterday. It was like, everybody in America has a GA who looks like Connor Stallions, which is actually true.
So true.
It's so true. It's absolutely true. But it's like kind of weird that there's this guy on the sidelines that, all right, they didn't identify because they couldn't. And he's wearing sunglasses at a night game. That's kind of weird. It's probably Connor Stallions. And then there's like this whole other slew of questions. How did he get on the sideline? Like, his name wasn't on the pass list, according to McElwain. But, like, oh my God, like this thing, this is going to be the gift that keeps on giving. But it's like the perfect social media story.
Yeah, it's, I'm just going to say, because it may or may not be interesting, McElwain and Michael Zordich, who's your assistant head coach, were Harbaugh assistants.
There's a lot of connections.
Connor Stallions was on the staff, I believe.
He would have been like, I think
21 is when he started.
Yeah, but I think before that he was maybe like,
he was dealing with these guys.
He was dealing with these guys, yes.
Right, but okay, so regardless, they would have crossed paths. So that's an interesting thing that you got to keep in mind. Yeah, let's find out for sure if it's him. You know, I definitely want to know that, but it fits what we've heard, that he's at games and he's taking notes.
We had a couple instances this week of coaches throwing players under the bus. Pat Narduzzi caught a lot of flack for it. They got beat at Pitt 58-7 by Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
And after the game, you know, Narduzzi is talking to the media and it's sort of a long answer. There's a lot going on. He does accept responsibility for what happened, but he sort of throws in, hey, listen, we lost a lot of guys from our team last year. Thought we had done a good job replacing them, but obviously we hadn't. And that little snippet sort of gets taken out and posted on social media, and then all of a sudden Pitt players are like, you know, quote tweeting it and using emojis and sarcasm, and it's like, okay, did he just lose the locker room? Narduzzi sort of doubles back and, you know, sort of apologizes and makes very clear that he's at fault for Pitt season completely going down the tubes. It's kind of a similar thing at Colorado. Like, Deion gets asked after the game, in the big picture, you know, how do you essentially keep Shadur upright? Shadur's taking a lot of punishment this year because their offensive line stinks. And Deion basically says, yeah, you get new linemen. That's how you address it. And he said, I'm going to paint the picture perfectly. Deion didn't seem to get as much flack as Narduzzi did. I'm sure we could get into a whole host of reasons on that. I think in both cases, the coaches are sort of telling the truth here.
Yeah.
But does the truth help you? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Narduzzi, like, how many times has Narduzzi lost the locker room, like, on a Tuesday? in his career at Pitt. Like, it's like an annual thing. He like says something, does something. It's all the time. I don't really have a problem with what either guy said. Like you kind of referenced this with Narduzzi. Like, I don't even know if what he said was that crazy. Like, they lost a lot of guys. They thought that they were going to replace those guys. Like, would it be great if he was like, yeah, I lost a lot of players off of last year's team. I thought I would be able to replace those guys. We failed as coaches. Would it be great to like make that distinction? Yeah, but
it's such a small distinction. It's such a small distinction. Who cares? Like, you understand what he's saying. You understand what he's talking about.
And with Deion, like, Deion's been like this from the start. Like, that's, I'm not going to fake outrage with that. Like, he said, you know, when the first time he met the team 9-10 months ago, like, pack your bags, you know, we're going to upgrade. So no problem at all with what either one of those guys said. I don't want to be selective with like picking guys apart. It's fine. But also, like, again, Dan and Paul got this right. We've been saying for a long time, Colorado looks really nice, but then you realize that their line sucks on both sides of the ball. So like, we knew this back in August, everyone said this would be the biggest challenge. And lo and behold, they're 4-4, and the biggest challenge has been finding linemen. This is the reason the Deion model will never really take shape. You can't bring in, you can't transfer portal linemen. There aren't enough of them, and you can't build cohesiveness. So that's why it was never going to take off, and it never will take off as a model.
But see, that's where I sort of question when he talks about getting new linemen. Where? How?
Right, like, right. Mm-hmm.
How's this going to change next year? Because, yeah, some of the guys they have, if they stay, they may get better, certainly. But you're not going to fix an offensive line with freshmen, generally speaking. And you're not going to really fix it with transfers, because I think it's the least likely position to build through the transfer portal. You may get a guy. You may get a guy here or there. But if you just look at the transfer portal over the last 3 years, it's a supply-demand problem. Offensive line is an incredibly developmental position. Frankly, a lot of offensive linemen, when they go to a Power 5 school, understand that they're going to redshirt, and then the first year they may be a backup, and it's really year three when they start to actually compete and perform, because they need to get bigger, better technique, stronger, like all these things. It just takes time. I just don't think you can portal your way to a good offensive line. It's going to take a lot of work. And I don't know if Colorado can do that work by next season. I find that very questionable as a strategy. And like, what if we're back here in a year talking about, okay, Colorado's, instead of, what are they, 4-4?
Uh-huh.
Okay, maybe they're 5-3. Is that really moving the needle? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I believe that one line transfer, like one transfer, can change your entire line, like in a specific way. Like, you get a left tackle in the portal who's a first round talent. Like, Oklahoma got this kid Walter Rouse, for example. Like, you get one guy like that, it can impact the quality of your entire line. It can shift a guy inside. It can allow a guy on the left side to move to the right side. Like, that can change the piece of the puzzle. But look, like, I don't know if everyone realizes this, but most FBS teams are carrying 16 to 18 or 19 scholarship linemen at a time. Like, maybe 19's a lot, 15 to 18, like, in a given year. That's how many linemen you have on scholarship. So Colorado's issue is not like maybe finding guy one or guy two. It's like trying to find guys 8 through 15. And that just can't, that, like you said, that cannot happen through the transfer portal. That you're just not going to do it that way. So they can get better year by year. But yeah, that's a concern of mine, is that you take strides across the board, but you're still kind of hamstringed by a line in year two. And you're right, like, they could be 5-3, a dramatically better team, like maybe better on defense, more depth, but still kind of hamstrung by the fact they can't block. So they're so bad now, Dan, that even if they were just like a step better next season, they would just be bad. Like, they would just be second half of the Power 5 bad. Right now, they're bottom of the Power 5 bad.
Okay, here's a question. Which first-year coach is doing a better job? And this is a bit of a weird question because these two teams played already. Deion Sanders or Matt Rhule? Who is doing a better job in the first year?
You know what? It's hard to say, right? So I think Deion, in terms of the off-field work and the attention he's brought, and it's hard to say that it's anyone but Deion, just because it's meant so much to the team and the school to have him do his thing. But you got to look at what Matt Rhule's done in Nebraska and the way that they're playing, and they're maximizing a pretty average or worse roster. I think it's a very fair question. I'm going to still say Deion because of, like I said, the off-field stuff. But I hope people are paying attention to what a lot of these younger or newer coaches are doing in terms of turning their years around. Rhule's one of a few guys who's done a nice job.
You and I both are Matt Rhule devotees. I think we both have a lot of respect and belief in his ability to turn around a program, to bring just a baseline level of competence to the job that will win you games. And we're seeing it play out at Nebraska. There's no tricks. There's no gimmicks. It's not even really like, oh yeah, they brought in an awesome quarterback like Shedeur Sanders who can keep you motoring. Like, there, a lot of things are a struggle for Nebraska because, let's face it, Scott Frost sucked. He sucked.
Yeah.
He did a terrible job. I mean, and I don't want it to be personal. I'm not trying to make it personal. Scott Frost did a crap job as the head coach of Nebraska and left that program in a bad, bad place. Personnel wise, like discipline wise, everything bad, bad, bad. But Matt Rhule is like one of those guys, like one of those few guys who, when you hire him as your head coach, like, I don't want to put him on the Urban Meyer level. Like, you know, you hire Urban, and that's why you still hear people talk about Urban, even though it's not going to happen. Like, yeah, you know, within 2 years you hire Urban Meyer, you're going to be in the mix. Like, with Matt Rhule, you hire him, you know you're going to be good. Because he's just that good. Like, he's just that awesome of a coach, and he's that competent. And look at the last 3 weeks, 20-7 over Illinois on the road, 17-9 over Northwestern, 31-14 over Purdue. We saw that defense the last few years under Scott Frost. It was comical.
Mm-hmm.
And Nebraska's got a long way to go here. But look at the rest of their schedule. At Michigan State, great opportunity for a win. They're favored in the game. Home against Maryland, great opportunity. At Wisconsin, great opportunity. Iowa at home, great opportunity. I mean, there's a chance they could be 9-3. I would probably lean toward 8-4.
Yeah, they could win the West.
But if Nebraska goes 9-3, I'm down to give Matt Rhule National Coach of the Year.
Oof. Yeah, I mean, look, that's a reflection of how bad the Big Ten West is. Like, I don't want to get it too twisted. Like, if they go 9-3, it's because the rest of these teams are hot trash. But I think one thing that I will say about Rhule, having watched and had a close seat to Temple, having watched and seen first year at Baylor, there's a level of buy-in and competitiveness and enthusiasm from year one at Nebraska that dwarfs anything we saw, certainly anything you saw year one at Temple, when the whole part of year one was just basically like, I'm going to strip you down to the absolute nuts and bolts and we're going to do it over again. So you're right. There's a high floor to Rhule. You know you're going to get successful football. You just know it. But I look at the fact that they could go 8-4, 9-3, potentially win the Big Ten West, and it's all systems go. I mean, I just feel like you've got to feel really good about the direction of things for that program. And like you said, the ability for him to step right in and fix what has been the problem for so long, which is a crappy defense, a weak-minded group, and a team that really was not up to the physical challenge of the Big Ten. So it's been a night and day change. So I'm glad we highlighted him because, A, we both really like him as a coach, and B, I mean, the work he's doing so far, I think, should have people extremely excited.
We did mention Iowa as Nebraska's final opponent of the regular season. That is a nice little segue into Brian Ferentz is out as Iowa's offensive coordinator at the end of this season. It was announced in a very strange press release, I thought, by the interim athletic director at Iowa, Beth Getz, who is probably going to be the permanent AD. I mean, I don't know that, but there's a good chance she's going to get the job permanently. But because of the nepotism rules, Brian Ferentz's direct reporting superior is not his father, the head coach. It's the athletic director. And so Kirk Ferentz's like signature is not on that press release. He's not quoted. He's not mentioned really. Like, it's just a weird situation. There was this whole thing in the preseason. If he averaged 25 points a game, his contract was going to get extended. They're off that pace. Credit to Bud Elliott, who put out a stat on Twitter this morning that if every offensive coordinator in the Big Ten West had the Brian Ferentz provision in the contract, none of them would meet it, would be meeting it by this point, which is just a shocking. It's just a shocking statistic about the weakness of the offenses in the Big Ten West.
Mm-hmm.
But just to focus on Iowa for a second, there's just so many like unanswered questions at this point about what this means. Is Kirk Ferentz just going to go hire another offensive coordinator? Is he going to retire? Like, what? It's such a bizarre situation, but it's the kind of thing that happens when you do the nepotism, which nobody should do right in coaching, but they do. And it went on way too long at Iowa. They let it happen for way too long. I'm glad for Iowa fans that they don't have to do this anymore after this year. It was sort of just this long-running sick joke. But what does it mean for Iowa? I'm not sure. Like, I'm not sure. Okay, Kirk Ferentz stays on next year with a different offensive coordinator. It's still his program. It's still his team. Is it going to be fundamentally different? It's interesting.
Yeah, definitely interesting. Also interesting to hear Ferentz the other day, very terse, I mean, terser than usual, about the announcement, about having any insight into it, any foreknowledge of it. So we could be heading up for a showdown, which would be really fun. I don't know what it means for Iowa. I just know that every time that Ferentz has hired an offensive coordinator in the past, it's come from in-house or it's been his son. So I don't foresee him like doing the Mike Gundy and like doing a national search and find the best available guy. I just think he's going to find the best fit. That's if he's even back next season. So this whole Ferentz at Iowa thing, it's just Brian and Kirk. It's just been going on for so long. I'm just so glad it's going to be over. But again, like another fight could be just begin.
All right. The final big news story of the week we have to address is Dabo Swinney. Good old Dabo going on his radio show on Monday night and blasting this guy, Tyler from Spartanburg, who called in and kind of, look, these call-in radio shows are a disaster. They have long been a disaster. It's funny that in 2023, you still have a situation where coaches will go on a radio show and take live calls from random people calling in.
And you know what's really funny about that, Dan, is that it is going away nationwide, which is heartbreaking. I think the coach's radio show and the coach's local TV breakdown of the game are two classic college football pieces that are both going away. But what's really funny about the radio show is like the two guys who you know do it still are Dabo and Saban.
Yeah.
Like those two guys. But anyway.
Yeah, but you know, and listen, most of the time, you know, I remember. Well, does Tennessee still do it? Vol calls was always a big deal.
Yeah, that was also good. I don't know anymore. That's a great question, but that was always a classic.
You know, I remember like way, way, way back in the day, I would always make a point when this is way back when Ed Orgeron was the coach at Ole Miss. I would always make a point to listen because I was living in Memphis at the time. It was on the radio in Memphis, and I'd always make a point to listen to that because I mean, you just didn't, you know. Ole Miss fans, Ed Orgeron, you just never knew what you were going to get.
Uh-huh.
But typically, if a caller like starts to ramble or starts to really go after a coach, like they'll just cut him off, which is what they should do, right? I mean, listen, these guys make a lot of money, and that doesn't make them immune from criticism. But there does come a certain point where you have to sort of maintain decorum, or it just gets stupid. And this guy was clearly making it personal and uncomfortable in his criticism of Sweeney. Now, Larry Williams of Clemson's Rivals site, I believe it's still affiliated with Rivals, actually found Tyler from Spartanburg, didn't use his last name, talked to him, and it was a good little piece. If you go,
he's awesome. Yeah.
If you go find that piece, it's a good story. It's worth reading. And he was sort of apologetic about, you know, the way he framed it, but he stood by his criticisms of the program and criticisms of Dabo maybe being a little bit, a little bit fat and happy, a little bit arrogant after winning the titles. Like, actually, I thought he said something that I've said. You know, I don't have any reason to like disguise this publicly. I mean, I used to talk to Dabo a lot. Like, I used to be pretty, I wouldn't say tight. Like,
you're pretty tight. Every time I would go down there, and I went down there a ton, he would ask about you. So I know the two of you used to be closer.
He won those two titles and he changed. That man changed. I just observed it. Okay. I can only go by what I observed in interactions, personal interactions. I mean, look, I don't ever expect somebody who I've criticized, which I have to do as a columnist, to like me or be my friend. I don't care about that. Like I don't care if college football coaches like me or not. Okay. But I am just telling you that Dabo changed, and I didn't change. I think success changed that whole program in a bad way. I do think they got fat and happy. I do think they got arrogant. I do think they got too dug in on certain things, and it's why they're now 4-4. Mm-hmm. And I do think that it's interesting that fans are starting to notice the same thing. Now, there's a way to do it. Tyler from Spartanburg didn't do it the right way. Dabo went off on this guy. I thought he made a lot of good points. And I do think if you're Dabo, you have every right to defend your track record, because the track record is awesome. And the track record would not exist as awesomely as it does if not for him and if not for what they accomplished there in this incredible run that was beyond anything Clemson could have dreamed of or imagined. But he is taking this criticism so personally that I think it's for one thing, it's sort of clouding his behavior. Like, you're Dabo Sweeney, man. You've won two national titles. You make $11 million a year. Why are you going off on some random dude calling into your radio show? Like, what? Why? Okay. Who cares? But also, I just don't think, like, fundamentally, he believes there's anything wrong with his program. I mean, he comes back at his press conference on Tuesday, his you know, his big press conference that he does every week. And he says, If we don't fumble the ball X number of times, we're 8-0. Well, okay. But you did fumble the ball. Right. Fumbling is part of football. And there's not a single team in the history of college football that I could identify, that I've ever seen, that has lost four games by being unlucky that is any good. They're not good. They're not good. They're an average ACC team. And yeah, as Dabo said, you're allowed to have a bad year. Coach K's had bad years. Bill Belichick's had bad years. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what people are seeing. That's not what I'm seeing. I'm not seeing a bad year where you're having bad luck and you're a fumble away from being in the playoff mix. I'm seeing a program in decline. And how are they going to fix it? And that's what Dabo needs to be focused on. And I just am not sure that's what's happening there.
Yeah, it's just like, to make it clear, like, they're 10th in the ACC. They're in 10th place in the ACC. All right? Like, they are who their record says they are. They're a mediocre football team. And what's striking to me, Dan, and we talk about Dabo a lot, but one thing that you would hear, not from him, but from people around the program in those in that 15 to 19 era, 16 and 18, where you'd always hear things like, you know, Dabo just willed this thing here. It's almost like he believed in it, and his faith and belief is what buoyed Clemson to two national championships. Like, there was that feeling around the program. You still feel him or see him or hear him try to will this thing forward, like with that talk about fumbles, with the talk about, hey, our offense is so young. Give us, you know, we're going to get better. I'm as confident now as I was back in 2010 that we will get it right. He's trying to will this thing forward. I think you need to see more dramatic changes in how they operate before you believe that he can actually turn it around again. Because like you said, the trending arrow is pointed so down on Clemson, it's just been shocking. So if they lose to Notre Dame, they're 4-5. They'll probably get into a bowl game at 6-6. And the credibility that they built up will have been erased going into next season.
Yeah. So what I would tell Dabo is, to his point about, yeah, we're a few fumbles away from being 8-0. What I would tell him is, actually, I think if you go back and look at like 21 and 22, you actually probably won more games than you should have, because I don't want to say you got a little lucky, but you know, there were games that there were 50-50 coin flip games that you won. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you didn't have some luck on your side, that we would have sort of seen this record start to disintegrate even sooner. Because the fundamental truth about where Clemson's at right now is the talent isn't there. I don't care about what the recruiting rankings say or what their classes have been ranked for the last few years. The high-end talent just isn't there. You know, everybody brings in, all of these elite programs bring in 4 and 5 stars. Not all of them hit. Some of them sort of play to a level, you know, kind of slightly lower than what they're ranked, or slightly higher or about the same. But when Clemson was winning national titles, what was actually happening is, yeah, they got the elite quarterback play from Trevor Lawrence and Deshaun Watson. But they also had some guys who just hit. Yeah. Some guys who, might have been low 4 stars who played like 5 stars, especially on the defensive line or whatever. Like, you had guys who really, really hit. That high-end, top-end talent's just not there. So, I don't know. It's interesting. It's going to be fun to see how they adjust or what they're going to do. But, like, that was a bad loss last weekend to NC State. Hmm. Terrible. NC State's not good at all.
Average. Just average. Yeah. And they made Clemson look bad. So, it's going to be an interesting final month. And not to say that it would be the worst thing, but I don't think it would be a great thing for Clemson to go 5-0 the rest of the way. I think going 5-0 will entrench some ideas that maybe need to be re-evaluated.
All right, we are going really long here. So
let's run through Saturday. What do we got?
Let's run through it. All right. Ohio State at Rutgers.
Blow it.
I think it could be interesting, actually. I think that could be a decent game. But I expect Ohio State to win. Kansas State at Texas. This is a big one. Noon on Fox. Guess. Because of the uncertainty with Ewers and the coaching, or what?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, because of the – if Ewers plays, I feel different. I mean, he's not going to. That's 98% sure. But Kansas State's been rolling as of late. They play a style that Texas has historically, or at least recent historically, has not responded well to. It just feels like a loss. So I'm going to Wildcats.
Big one for Jimbo Fisher, A&M at Ole Miss. Ole Miss is a slight favorite. Probably an Ole Miss win.
Yeah, probably.
We can jump back on the Jimbo storyline. All right, we mentioned Clemson, Notre Dame at Clemson. Notre Dame is favored by 3. It's the noon ABC game. I don't know how Clemson's going to score.
Yeah, I still want to pick Clemson to win this game. I mean, just because of what I believe about the program or what we've seen from the program, but I don't know how you pick them. I mean, Notre Dame's a much more certain thing, and 3 points actually seems like a low amount of points they're getting. They should be a touchdown favorite.
All right, UConn at Tennessee. Why are these two teams playing in football and not women's basketball?
I know. Or
even men's basketball?
And also, why on November 1st? Why is this not your November 19th game? Whatever.
Missouri at Georgia. Georgia starting to look like Georgia. I do think there's a lot more confidence coming out of there now. They're getting some guys back. They're starting to let Carson Beck cook a little bit. But Missouri's offense is a real challenge. They're playing well. I mean, they're 7-1. That's a good team. What shape is this game going to take?
Yeah, I think Missouri is a pretty good team, and they can get downfield on Georgia. Luther Burden is one of the top receivers in the country. I mean, they could potentially score a couple points on Georgia, but I thought the way the Bulldogs played against Florida, I don't want to call it a turning point. These guys have won 24 SEC games in a row, but it did feel like the Georgia that we've been used to seeing, that performance, and that it came without Bowers at tight end, and that they were still humming in the passing game. That's a good sign. So I think Georgia physically can push Missouri around, but also think they can do some things through the air. So what, 14, 17 points? That to me feels about right. 14.
We got Bedlam, possibly the last Bedlam in quite a long time. And I'll tell you, a player that is not gotten talked about nationally enough, but will if he has a huge game this weekend, is Ollie Gordon II.
Yep.
The running back from Oklahoma State is averaging he's averaging 7.7 yards per carry this year on 141 carries. That's absurd.
Yep. He has played his way into the Heisman conversation. I mean, he's the number one running back in the country right now. Dan, I'm taking the Cowboys in this one. Mike Gundy, I do not believe, is going to allow. If he didn't really want to lose to Oklahoma, he wouldn't have lost 15 of 18 times or whatever the number is. But it feels to me like this is the kind of game that he wins.
Yeah. I think so, too.
I'm taking the Cowboys.
I kind of am with you on that. All right. Washington at USC. So we talked about Washington's issues the last few weeks. Is this the week where the loss hits them because just it's been building and building and building and they kind of need a loss?
Yeah, so they play USC, then they play Utah, and then Oregon State, then the Apple Cup. So
that's a tough
really
stretch.
Difficult. Yeah, yeah, really difficult November. To me, the one on paper that seems like it could give them the most trouble is SC, because SC can to Stanford with Washington. Like, they can get into a game where it's up and down, up and down, up and down, and have the offense to just, you know, win a game that gets into the 40s. So, yeah, I think this is a danger game for Washington. I don't know if I'm going to pick SC yet, but you can't look at this game and not acknowledge the Trojans have a shot at winning a shootout.
And then finally, LSU at Alabama. Alabama 3-point favorite. Probably the winner goes to Atlanta for the SEC championship game, most likely. Certainly there's permutations of the SEC West race that could lead to a different outcome, but this is kind of the game that you look forward to every year. Maybe not as much this year as in years past. LSU 6-2. You know, their defense just has not been all that good, but Alabama's offense is not that good. You know, Jaden Daniels has had a great year, and he's also in the Heisman conversation. And, you know, if they go in and beat Alabama, that's probably not the result that helps the SEC in the playoff race.
No.
But it's certainly one that I could see happening because, yeah, I give Alabama all the credit for kind of hanging in there and getting to 7-1. But as we've said before, it's just not pretty ever.
No, it's not. I think they're going to win because it's at home. I mean, I know that the aura of invincibility has been taking a hit this year at home, but I like Alabama at home, but I really can't articulate why. This is a really difficult game to pick. Alabama's method for winning has been to just weigh on teams. I mean, LSU doesn't want to play that style. I don't know if they want to get into that type of game. They want their offense to be on the field running at a tempo, and Alabama doesn't want that. So it is a mismatch of styles or a mix of styles. I'm taking Alabama because of home field, but I will say, Dan, they win this game, they will be 11-1 because it's Kentucky, I think it's Chattanooga, then it's Auburn the rest of the way. If they go 11-1, this coaching job by Saban has been unreal. So we'll see. It's a toss-up. I don't know what you think about the game, but this is a real toss-up to me.
Yeah, I may be leaning a little to LSU. I just think their offense is very good. It's a very good offense. And if they can just get the lead, like I think they have to play from ahead. I think if they play from ahead and get Bama uncomfortable and doing things offensively that is that are just sort of beyond their capability, that's the recipe for LSU to win. So I think it's just kind of one of those games where if LSU gets out to like a 10-0 lead, I think they're going to win.
Yeah. And obviously Alabama wins this game, they'll probably move higher in the playoff rankings, and it'll come down to that in Georgia.
Yep.
In the SEC championship game once again.
All right, that is a week on the College Football Fix podcast. Man, we had to get through a lot of stuff. It's just so much happening.
I know.
It's been fun, though. All right, for Eric Smith, our producer and our college sports editor at USA Today Sports, and for Paul Meyerberg, I'm Dan Wolkin. Thanks for listening. Come back next week, same time, same place, with the College Football Fix podcast.
The College Football Fix podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix podcast from USA Today Sports.